I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Kenya Curtis is an outsider, a misfit at her public school in West Philadelphia because she's a gifted student whose family celebrates Kwanzaa, and later at an elite school for girls in the suburbs because she's one of the few black students. Kenya is the protagonist in Asali Solomon's debut novel called Disgruntled. It follows her struggles to understand her unconventional family, the meaning of home and community, and to find her place in the world. Solomon set her novel in the city where she grew up and drew in part on her own life, the daughter of black nationalist parents who sent her to the Baldwin School for Girls in the Philadelphia suburbs. Asali Solomon lives in Philadelphia now, not far from where she grew up, and she teaches creative writing in English literature at Haverford College, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio, and congratulations on the novel, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. You're very welcome. I'd love to begin with actually the very beginning of your book to have you read some to us.
Okay. In the first grade at Henry Charles Lee School in West Philadelphia, when Kenya told kids that she celebrated Kwanzaa, no one knew what she was talking about. By the third grade, led by the tiny tyrant Letitia Simmons, the kids were calling her an African booty scratcher and chanting to a conga line rhythm, "You don't get no presents, you don't get no presents." In fact, she did get presents on the last morning of Kwanzaa, 7 days after Christmas. By the fourth grade, Kenya was down to one friend. It wasn't just the Kwanzaa problem. And anyway, she could have lied about Kwanzaa, like she suspected Fatima McCullers did. Fatima, whose dad had dreadlocks and who always said Christmas and Santa Claus with wavering inflection. It was also that Kenya couldn't eat any pork, including the bologna sandwiches that were the everyday fare of the lunchroom. Something to do with her father muttering that white people force slaves to eat hog guts. Now, as far as Kenya could see, white people loved bologna enough to give it both a first and a second name. It was that Kenya wasn't allowed to watch Gimme a Break, Good Times, or Different Strokes, because according to her mother, watching black people on TV acting the fool was worse than not watching any at all. It was that Kenya was forbidden to actually speak the Pledge of Allegiance and had been directed to mouth it with her hand, not actually touching her chest. It was that she had to call her father Baba, and when she'd asked if she could call him Daddy, like other people, it had triggered what seemed like days of lectures during which Kenya learned to hate the phrase other people. It was that while her parents said grace like normal people, they directed it to the Creator instead of God. It was that she was never, ever allowed to say nigger, even during the step where they had to say nigger boy. In fact, when she first heard someone say it in school, Letitia Simmons in the third grade, Kenya said, "Ooh," expecting everyone to join in. They didn't. Even Aaliyah, the pale girl from Sudan, actual Africa, but no one called her a booty scratcher, with a long rope of hair, was laughing at her. And when Kenya pointed at Letitia, explaining she said the N-word, they laughed even harder.
And that's Asali Solomon reading from the very beginning of her debut novel. It's called Disgruntled. And I have to say, I mean, that novel kind of opens with a bang. I mean, we meet Kenya, but here's a girl who wants to live by the rules that her parents have set for her. Yeah, she's a kid. You know, she's a kid in public school who wants to be like other kids.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the themes, you know, the strongest themes in the novel, which is that you come from a certain background, but the rule of law in school, no matter where you're in school, is fit in. And I think this is a thing that as soon as people sort of graduate from being students to being parents, they kind of forget.
They forget how hard it is to be a kid sometimes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the hegemony of childhood and the, you know, you just want to fit in, you know.
The hegemony of childhood.
Right. Like it's all about, it's interesting because I think a lot of children, I mean, not a lot of people in general, but a lot of children would prefer to not be seen and to be ignored than to stand out negatively, you know, or even stand out in a lot of different ways.
Was this book, I mean, did writing this book get you thinking about your own childhood? There are some parallels. I don't want to make too much of it, but there are some parallels
here. Well, I mean, I think the thing is that actually I've never really stopped thinking about my own childhood, which is like how this book comes to be. And, you know, the book of short stories I wrote before this, Get Down, was primarily about young people. And so, you know, I think it's more just the continuing process of thinking about my childhood and what it meant.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think for some people, they do exactly what you do, which is to think a lot about sort of where they came from and their mm-hmm. parents. And for others, it's sort of turning your back, shutting the door, saying, those days are over. Now I'm an adult and I'm not going to look back.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because you read novels sometimes that are about adults in the world and their whole world is about, where they are sort of now and not really. But, I mean, I think so much of who you become, there are two mm-hmm. things. One is that so much of who you become is determined by some of your early experiences. But the other part of it is that I think that childhood and school and these kind of things are also a microcosm for dynamics that remain and things that are still in play, but they're less subtle in childhood.
I mean, were you one of those kids like Kenya that had, a couple of friends, obviously a smart student, a very good student that felt a little bit on the outskirts of what was going on?
Well, so yes, but I have to say that I don't think that it was, I think there's a thing in this book that says something to the effect of Kenya wished that she was marginalized because she was smart. That wasn't really the case. there were other smart kids. That wasn't really it. It was that I was different in some of the ways that are described about Kenya, but also I just felt that, I was mm-hmm. a kind of an awkward kid. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was a baby, my grandma would tell a story about how she would have to ask permission to kiss me when I was a small child. So it was like a combination of like inherent social awkwardness and this kind of difference.
You turn away if your grandma wanted to kiss you?
Yeah, it was, I loved my grandma, but I was just a weird kid or like, at a young age. Well, occasionally we would go out for dinner at restaurants and instead of socializing, I was like, can I bring a book, and just I'll read until the food comes. And that wasn't very popular.
Well, let's talk about Kenya's parents, Sheila and John Brown. I should say to our listeners, John Brown, that's his one name. I mean, the two words are put together. Sheila, her mom grew up in the Richard Allen Projects. And mm-hmm. I should say to our listeners, especially if you're not from Philadelphia, that did exist. Then she goes to Franklin and Marshall. I mean, she seems to be, and she's raised by a single mom, mm-hmm. determined to I guess, get out of the ghetto, get an education.
Yeah, I mean, she's upwardly mobile. She wants to change her social class. She wants to change her circumstances. And, I mean, one of the things I enjoyed about creating that character was this idea that, like, her mom worked so hard so Sheila could have almost like a life of leisure. Like, she just had all this time to think about her thoughts and how to, invent herself because her mom worked, sort of slaved. And then there's the thing about how the mom kind of basically took in a foster daughter to, like, help with this project in the process, sort of sacrificing the foster daughter. But, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are really interested in that character and Sheila, and her trajectory.
Well, and one of the things, and I think it sort of shows how difficult it is sometimes to be political and to be consistent. Is she somebody who, as you say, who complains about TV shows that she wouldn't miss? For mm-hmm. instance, I think it's some kind of a cop show that she criticizes, but also would never miss. I mean, it's difficult to live a very pure life, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, I was thinking about Hill Street Blues, which incidentally, my parents did not watch that. I think they saw one episode that they pronounced racist and that was it for Hill Street Blues. But, yeah, like I think, and she also has a thing about Gone with the Wind.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're going to be, popular culture in a lot of ways is a place that preserves a lot of the negative dynamics, negative social dynamics. And so if you're going to participate in popular culture, I mean, this is something that happens in America with all kinds of racial minorities or, lesbian and gay people, if you're going to participate in popular culture, sometimes you're going to participate in images that are like destructive to you,
Well, and the quote is that her mom, Sheila, liked a police show that she repeatedly denounced as racist but never missed.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Exactly.
No.
Now, her dad, John Brown, was raised in a middle-class family
yeah.
in suburban Philadelphia. But also, he says about them, they were not good people.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, his family is, the idea is that his family was sort of upwardly mobile, sort of very colorist, just not like their main goal was to get ahead socially. and economically and not necessarily be very humane. I mean, I think there's definitely a critique of John Brown in the novel. And in a way, perhaps he's more his parents' children than he suspects. But that's the idea with them, is that they're just kind of hard people who really have this agenda that they don't want anything else to get in the way of.
Well, and John Brown, I mean, you could describe him one way as a kind of a dreamer. He's a philosopher.
Yeah,
doesn't really work.
I mean, not so much.
Much to Sheila's chagrin, I would say, to some degree.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, like, they agree on a number of things. You know, they agree on the idea that it's very important for Kenya to have a sense of what it means to be African-American in America, and that she has a sort of proud ancestry, history, a proud history of struggle, but at the same time, you know, just the danger of racism. And I think John Brown and Sheila agree on these things, but John Brown is a little focused on, you know, the grand project of sharing his mind with the world, and, you know, in his grand philosophical treatise. And I think, you know, there's a narcissism there.
Well, and at the same time, I mean, he's working on this thing called The Key.
Right.
It's a black philosophy, a way of living for non-black people.
Right. Yeah.
Right. What's the key for him?
No, it's a key for all people, right?
Right.
So The Key is meant to be like his synthesis of philosophy and spirituality. I mean, I think it's like a sort of like a male project. Like, I'm going to unlock, you know, tell you how to do everything. You know, I am a person who could read many books and then tell you all about how to do everything.
Kind of special knowledge.
Yeah,
in a
special
way.
Knowledge. Encyclopedic, you know. And I think encyclopedic is the word. And I think that I got that from Middlemarch. I didn't realize I got that from Middlemarch. But there's a character in the Victorian novel Middlemarch who is working on The Key to All Mythology. And it's this project that's never going to be finished, that no one's interested in. And the character Kasaba and his wife Dorothea is this young woman who's his kind of acolyte. So she's like bringing him tea and very worried about him finishing The Key. But he will never finish The Key to All Mythology. And I think I sort of got it from that.
I mean, there's something kind of weirdly heroic about that, isn't it? I mean, to work on something that'll never be finished and never be read by anybody.
In a sense, except it's not helping anyone except you. So that, like, the heroism is a little less in that case.
I mean, do you see him as a narcissist?
John Brown?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I mean, everybody is. But I think, like, to the degree that he sort of sacrifices his family for some of his ideals, I think a little destructively self-involved. That being said, I think both he and Sheila are, you know, involved in their self-making in a way that sort of harms Kenya.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll pick up on that. Our guest is Asali Solomon. She is actually teaches creative writing and English literature at Haverford College, and she's written her debut novel. It's called Disgruntled. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Asali Solomon about her new novel. It's her debut novel. It is called Disgruntled. I should add that her first book, Get Down, was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award for Debut Fiction. And if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about a whole bunch of stuff that's involved in this story. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Kenya is an only child, and oftentimes I think only children don't have an ally to battle their parents. It's really them in many ways against their parents. Was that by design? Did you want to sort of have her in a sense by herself?
That's a good way of thinking about that. But I think it was like this book is very different from my life, but I had a sister. And I think that it just seemed complicated to involve a sibling in the story to me. I mean, it was a very the process of moving from short stories to novel writing was very difficult for me. And so there were some things I had to really keep streamlined. And adding the sibling, I think, would have just really made it complicated.
And she's a sleepwalker. I mean, a pretty serious sleepwalker.
Yeah. I mean, and that also is related to me trying to figure out my way through a novel, because the sleepwalking brings in plot elements that move the story forward, because the hardest thing for me for moving to a novel was designing something called plot, because plot is very artificial. And so when you're writing realist fiction, that is one of the most difficult things to bring in, because life has no plot, really.
Right. Maybe only in hindsight.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. So as it's happening, it's not. You have to – and so it's something you really have to manufacture in a specific way. And so sleepwalking was something that – although, incidentally, my sister was the one who slept walk. I mean, she was nowhere near as serious as Kenya. It was a very brief period. But yeah, that also must have suggested itself to me through her, ironically.
I mean, do you, as a sister, do you remember sort of waking up and finding your sister in someplace
else? No, it wasn't that. It was stuff I would hear about the next day.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, my parents or whatever would find her wandering around.
It's such a curious thing, isn't it?
It is, really. Yeah, it is. I don't know that much about it, but I sort of thought it was interesting. And in a way, I mean, again, like what I've written so far is realism, but I'm always very interested in people who sort of add elements of, you know, what people call magical realism or people call fantasy or people call fabulism. And so I think sometimes I like to add things that push in that direction, and sleepwalking is one of them.
Her father, John Brown, is a really fascinated by this, and this is a real character, Julian Carleton. He was actually a butler for Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah, that's right.
Burned one of Wright's house down and killed a lot of people.
He did. He set the house on fire and stood at the door with an axe and killed 7 people. And it was a very crazy story that someone, a friend of mine, told me about, just apropos of nothing. Oh, have you ever heard this story?
I've never heard that story. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It seems like it's a story that should be kind of famous because Wright is so famous. But it is not very well known. And it's interesting. I actually went out to Taliesin a couple times.
Like, this is the house?
Yeah, the house. And it's fascinating if you look at Taliesin from the perspective of someone who worked there. It's a kind of fascinating tour.
How so?
Well, in that, you know, and this is something that's in the novel, Frank Lloyd Wright was very interested in these, like, wide open spaces with a lot of light, even though they were indoor spaces. But the kitchen was this tiny, unpleasant place. And, you know, a lot of the passageways that you would have had to walk along if you were, you know, a servant were squinchy. And the basement where they slept was like a dark sort of grotto-like place. And, you know, some people would ask, like, frankly, they would ask him, like, why is the kitchen so sort of unpleasant? He would say, well, I don't cook.
I don't go there. Someone else
does
that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So.
So why did Julian Carl? I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't in the house when he
he was away.
Why did he do what he did?
I mean, I think he was completely insane. That story is actually the genesis of this novel in a lot of ways. And so someone told me that story. Actually, a good friend of mine, Jason Moran, who's the pianist composer, and we've done a couple things together. We're friends, and he had seen this on A&E or something.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, isn't this story interesting? And what was interesting about it was that it was such an overdetermined story of a disgruntled employee. Like, it was because, you know, he was Frank Lloyd Wright's his partner did fire Julian Carleton, and that was when he decided to do this. So that's a very dramatic response. And then there was something that was suggested about him being a black employee. He's Barbadian. So there's something sort of depressing about the idea of these Barbadians who turned up in the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin early in the 20th century and then got fired. And so I just thought there was like an inherent drama to the story and thinking about being disgruntled and what that meant.
I mean, disgruntled almost hardly describes
his disgruntled
state of mind.
Disgruntled is a better way of describing, I think, Kenya and some of the other characters in the novel. But it's since literally when people do things like that, they refer to them as disgruntled employees, you know, that's kind of the connection.
And so what's Kenya's father, John Brown, he's really kind of obsessed with this guy.
Yeah, he's interested in this because he's interested in accessing like the pure rage and anarchy in himself, even though he has not really done anything like that, but it's like a part of him that he's really fascinated with and interested in accessing. And so in his fascination with that's what that's about.
I mean, one never gets the feeling that Kenya's father would ever do anything like that. I mean,
no.
He might talk about it.
Yeah, no.
But no. Would never actually do
no,
it.
No, he would never do anything like that. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a kind of fantasy of you know, expressing himself in a dramatic fashion.
He and his we learn out that they're not married, but he right. and his Kenya's mother
yeah.
Have a group that meets at the house,
right.
7 Day.
Yeah, the 7 Days. So that actually is based on something that is in a Toni Morrison novel, Song of Solomon. There's a group called the 7 Days in that novel that they're black men. And whenever a black person is killed by a white person in their community, they seek to kill a white person in the same fashion, right? On the same day of the week. And so in my novel, they're interested in that, but they're not going to kill anyone. That's just their way of thinking about, you know, the 7 days in this book are just trying to improve life for black people in their community and doing different things.
This girl, Kenya, is haunted by this phrase. It's a phrase coming from her father, the shame of being alive.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I just kept thinking about that because shame is just such a shameful word. I mean, I don't know any way around that, but there's something so deep about right. that feeling of shame.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think – and so what that's about is you're ashamed, but not necessarily. It's like, you know, when – in the passages, you know, she goes to these depressing cultural programs, and it's like the fact that she's even there makes her feel bad. So it's everyone else's shame as well, right?
But at the same time, I mean, her parents want her to be proud of her
right.
self. I mean,
yeah.
it's not like they want her to be ashamed of being.
No, of course not. Yeah. But I mean, I think like marginalization or feeling outcasted and a feeling of shame often go hand in hand, even though they, you know, I think that's a human feeling.
Is that something you can relate to?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, like, I think what it is it's a way of taking the feeling of being outcasted into yourself, right? I mean, that's what it is. So I think, yeah, sure, I've definitely had that. And you know, I was young, so I think young people probably experience it more than other people.
Sure.
I mean, just the shame that your parents showed up to pick you up from somewhere. Like the shame of being alive, you know.
That they looked at you or wanted to hold your hand
yeah,
or something
right,
like
right,
that.
Exactly.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Asali Solomon, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She teaches creative writing and English literature at Haverford College. She grew up here in Philadelphia. In fact, lives now back in the city, not far from where she grew up. And she's got a new novel, her debut novel, and it's called Disgruntled. And I see some comments from some of our listeners. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, let me read a tweet from Nate. He says, I'm reading Disgruntled, and I'm astonished how much my life has paralleled Kenya as a kid who grew up in North Philadelphia. Ms. Solomon has perfectly captured the experience of us 1980s kids from North Philly with Afrocentric parents.
Thank you. Yeah, I've gotten some mail and some emails to that effect, and it's actually surprising to me how many people were sort of in this, you know, sort of came from a similar background and experience. And even people who came from a background where, you know, their parents were Afrocentric and taught them a certain number of values and wound up in majority white private schools.
Well, and I want to get to that, but let me ask you a bit about your parents before we do that. I mean, I described them as black nationalists.
Right.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, just how, I guess, how political was your family growing up?
I mean, the thing about it is like my parents, I've been going around the country describing them as black nationalists, which is true. But I think to a lot of people that implies a level of political activity that I don't mean it to mean. I simply mean that they instilled in us a value system that we thought of ourselves as part of this entity, right? And that was a black community in America and a wider black community in the diaspora. And that's actually a very specific way of thinking of yourself as an American. And to that end, you know, we were just taught a great deal about African-American history, African-American heritage, the, you know, racism, and what our responsibilities were as black people. And so that's, you know, and they definitely were politically active in that. They were very conscious of a lot of different issues, you know, like incursions in Nicaragua. That was something they were interested in, or apartheid, you know. And so that's when I describe them, that's sort of what I mean.
Did you celebrate Kwanzaa?
We did celebrate Kwanzaa.
I mean, and not Christmas.
We did not celebrate Christmas. No, no. I wasn't raised. I wasn't raised Christian. And so part of it was that we didn't celebrate Christmas, although I'm aware that that's a secular holiday. But,
exactly.
Yeah. We right.
And like Kenya, was it kind of like, oh, can't we celebrate Christmas like everybody else?
I mean, Christmas just seems so mindlessly fun to me. Like, you didn't have to think at all about, like, slavery or anything like that. You know, it was just, there was something, Kwanzaa was a celebration for sure, but there was something, you know, deep and sort of profound about thinking about what it meant to be African American and your responsibilities to a community. And that is just not the same thing as was like eating sugar cookies and getting presents. Like, you know, so, I enjoyed our family celebrations, but you know, I was a kid. And
how about today? I mean, you have a family, you have two kids. What do you do about holidays?
Yeah. Well, so what I do is, you know, I'm married to a Jewish man. We're raising the kids Jewish, and they celebrate Kwanzaa and Hanukkah. It's kind of a long holiday
season.
This
is America, though. I mean, this is sort of more and more what families are doing, don't you think?
Right, yeah. But it's, you know, that's what we do.
In this novel, Kenya goes to it's called the Barrett School for Girls. It's in suburban Philadelphia. As you mentioned, you went to the Baldwin School, which is a girls' school in suburban Philadelphia. And I was thinking about, you know, here are these Black nationalist parents, both in the novel, but also in your real life, who decide to send their daughter, in your case, to a largely white girls' school. What were your parents thinking?
I mean, they were thinking that they were very frustrated with the school district of Philadelphia, and they, you know, and I'll, at the same time that I moved there, a fair amount of Black people that we knew moved their kids there. The Baldwin, I believe, was doing a kind of diversity drive, and you know, they were offering pretty good scholarships, and it was, you know, they really just wanted me to get a good education. And And I think for a lot of families in this situation, a lot of times the people we're describing as Black nationalists are also people who are very who are educated and very think a lot about what their children's education might mean and know a little bit about their options. And so that is how you get the situation that seems deeply ironic, where you have these kids who wind up in these majority white private schools. But you know, it presented itself as an option at a time where they really felt like they were running out of options in the school district.
Was it a good move for you? I mean, was that a good place for you?
I think it was good and it was bad. It was, you know, it was socially difficult in a lot of ways. It was, you know, it was a really solid education. But I heard Wilmore, who now hosts the Late Show after The Daily Show, say in an interview that he had gone to a school like this and it was like going to a family reunion but not being part of the family. And that is a very, like, I've spent a lot of pages trying to describe this experience, but all I really needed to say was that. That's what it was like.
Well, in the novel, the mom's, you know, her observation looking at the students is the more money they have, the worse they look.
That's right. Yeah. No,
you know, you look like a poor kid, you know, even though you're a rich kid.
Yeah, right. And nobody wants to admit that they're rich, which is something I actually talked to my college students about, you know, about like, oh, you know, no one ever would admit.
Everyone's middle class.
Everyone's
right?
middle class. No one's rich, you know.
I had to chuckle because at one point Kenya eats she eats shepherd pie for the first time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You just rolled your eyes at me.
That's not a favorite of mine. I remember doing that, but it wasn't at somebody's house. It was like, but it was some weird Baldwin field trip. Like, there was a Greek restaurant involved and there was shepherd pie. And I was
Did you have the same reaction to it?
I did. Yeah, I did.
There's a student in this novel who's trying to pass for Black.
Yeah.
You know, which is sort of, it's such an interesting take on passing.
Yeah. I mean, and it's odd, right? So she wants, I think that character, Debbie, feels very out of sorts, feels like an alien in her own house. And she wants her outside to reflect her inside in some way. And that's the way she can think of to do it. Right.
Which makes sense. I mean, in certain kind of ways.
Yeah, in a certain kind of way it makes sense. I mean, she's also very troubled. Yes. But, yeah.
Someone emailed, I guess, for your children, celebrate Kwanzaa.
I mean, which yeah, I no, I mean, we,
Kwanzaa, and Kwanzaa,
or you know, like we'll refer to the season as Kwanamus. A good friend of mine, Kwanamus Dawn. You know, I had Ramadan in there. Yeah, Kwanzaa. Celebrate Kwanzaa.
You do live rather close to where you grew up, and I mean, you know, oftentimes people say you can't go home again, but obviously people do all the time.
Yeah.
Is it sort of heartening to see familiar things or perhaps to see how much things have changed since you were a kid growing up in West Philly?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, a lot of things look the same. It's different. I mean, that neighborhood used to be, you know, the neighborhood is still predominantly black where my mm-hmm. parents live, but a lot more white people have moved in. You know, I think it's part of a national sort of like gentrifying of cities. People whose parents moved out to the suburbs, they're sort of moving back to the city. And it's just always interesting to see things that you have seen as a child or you've seen your whole life from a totally different perspective. You know, like I've always had an interesting emotional relationship with the Penn campus. But as an adult, like yesterday, I was on the campus as part of a writing retreat, and I went to some buildings I'd never been into, and I was like, wow, oh, this is like totally fascinating. But, you know, I think one of the things is I didn't plan to live as close to my parents as I do, but I have two small children, and it's been enormously helpful. So there's that.
There is that. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Asali Solomon about her new novel, her debut novel. It is called Disgruntled. And again, she teaches creative writing and English literature at Haverford College, which is just outside of Philadelphia, and joins us on Radio Times. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with writer Asali Solomon. She grew up in West Philadelphia, the daughter of, she says, black nationalist parents. They sent her to the Baldwin School. That's an elite private girls' school in the city suburbs. Solomon's debut novel, Disgruntled, draws in part from her own life. And again, it's about Kenya Curtis. She's raised by unconventional parents in West Philadelphia. They send their daughter to a mostly white girls' school in the suburbs. And our guest, Asali Solomon is talking about how the story is and isn't like her own. And she teaches English literature and creative writing at Haverford College. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have an email from Patricia. She says, the story you talked about is told in the book Loving Frank by Nancy Horan.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
right.
This is about...
There's a couple of novels that came out a couple of years ago about Frank Lloyd Wright, and both of them, I think, have something about that. Yeah, right.
And why was that particular true story, why did that become the sort of nub, or how did that become the nub of this novel?
I mean, it part of it had to do with the time that I learned about it. It was like I was sort of thinking about what I, you know, I wanted to write a novel, and I was thinking about what was interesting to me, but... it sort of just became, it's a sort of very, it was sort of emblematic of other things I was interested in, but much more dramatic mm-hmm. than the things I was interested in.
I mean, because the sort of, I guess the, I mean, the servant class,
the servant class, the rage, the sort of, I mean, the implicit racism, the violence that took place and like all of those things. Mm.
And this is set in Philadelphia. I mean, was it easier for you to write about a place that you know so well? I mean, to set a story in a place you know so well.
Yeah, I mean, everything I've written about so far is set in Philadelphia. And I think that it is, I mean, I've lived different places at this point. I lived outside of Philadelphia for 20 years. But it's not just that it's easier. It's that I was sort of interested, the writer Edward P. Jones writes his novels and short fiction about Washington, D.C., and every time he does that and insists on the sort of specificity of it, he sort of mythologizes it in this interesting way. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do that.
Oh, interesting.
You know, I also think Philadelphia is, I think the African-American community in Philadelphia is like very particular in this. There's a sort of esoteric element there, like, you know, sort of black cultural nationalism, health food, like a lot of the things that I, like, consequently learned about in California had been going on in sort of black communities in Philadelphia for, you know, years, you know, since a sort of hippie kind of blackness I think you find in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. That I thought was interesting.
Does that describe your parents? Hippie blackness?
No, my parents are not hippies at all. But, you know, but I kind of knew, like, the way that I learned about, like, foods like tofu and that kind of thing, you know, or dulse or whatever, where, you know, I had this aunt, Yvette Smalls, who was a hair braider, a master hair braider, and was, like, really into health food. And, like, the first place where I saw people drinking, like, spring water at room temperature, like, that kind of thing, you know.
There was an article about you in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you describe your family as royalty, as Philadelphia royalty.
Well, so thinking about my grandmother, who, right. Mamie Nichols, who was a community activist in South Philadelphia, and, you know, if you mention Mamie Nichols to – she passed away a couple of years ago, but, you know, I went to something and I saw the, you know, former Mayor Wilson Good, and if you just say Mamie Nichols, you would just get this expression. And a lot of, like, city officials or people who have been in politics for a long time in the city knew who she was. She was a sort of she was a force, you know. She was a force for her community.
Right. And a force within the family.
And a force within the family as well. Yeah, for sure. And then my uncle, who passed away last year, is Richard Nichols. And he was the longtime manager of the Roots and really helped create sort of their institution.
This book also involves the MOVE bombing. And you know, this year marks the 30th anniversary of the MOVE bombing. This was in West Philadelphia, Osage Avenue.
Right.
This bunker was bombed by the police and people were killed. A whole neighborhood practically was burned down.
Right.
You were, I think you said about fifth or sixth grade.
About fifth grade. Yeah. No.
And you have memories of that?
I mean, do.
I certainly have memories of that.
No, I mean, I have two distinct memories of it. One is that, you know, the day before it happened or 2 days before it happened, we were in a car listening to a call-in radio show about it. And I remember thinking, you know, people from neighbors were calling the show and complaining about it. And I remember thinking, there's no good way out of this.
Yeah.
Like, I was little. I had no idea. But I was like, you know, I couldn't figure out what was the way they were going to get out of this. And then I remember watching it on TV, you know.
And I think everyone's saying, put the fire out.
And it was, I mean, it was surreal. But also, there's a really excellent documentary called Let the Fire Burn. And I saw that a couple of years ago, and it was, like, almost traumatic because since that documentary is entirely archival material, it was things that I had watched in real time. And so watching them again was, I mean, it was so, it was very, very chilling. I mean, the whole thing is very scary, you know.
And I think, I mean, it is a very Philadelphia story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I think people, when you tell people about it, they just think, what?
Yeah. I mean, all the, there's so many, you know, particular dramatic elements to it. You know, you have your first African-American mayor, you know, who in some sense the black people in the city want him to protect them. And in some sense that includes the people who want him to get rid of MOVE, right? But then you also have this sort of white establishment of the police and in some sense the fire commissioner who had come in with the sort of previous mayor who was well known for being hostile to MOVE and the black community. And it's this completely volatile mix, you know, and then you have MOVE. You know, not good neighbors, but didn't really deserve to be burned alive for that sin.
Indeed. Do you remember your parents talking about them or this?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember my parents talking about it much. I mean, I remember that it was like when it, you know, when this happened, it was a tragedy. You know, it was like a horrible and a violent tragedy. It wasn't just like, oh, who did this? You know, it was clear. The sort of forces of violence and racism that had been behind this. But,
yeah, terrible situation. Let me get Ashanta from, looks like, Blackwood to join us. Hi, Ashanta. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just want to let you know, first, I am definitely enjoying the interview.
Thanks.
So my question is, you talked so profoundly about your childhood, and you stated that you have two small kids. My question is, would you prefer to raise them in a similar manner as your parents raised you, or would you, are you taking a different route?
Thanks, Ashanta.
No, I mean, I think as far – well, my kids are tiny. I mean, they're small. They're 2 and they're 5. So I haven't talked to them about a lot of the things my parents talked to me about, but I will. You know, I mean, I think it's difficult because you want kids to be educated, but you don't want them to – feel frightened or disempowered by talking to them about things like the forces of racism and these different national and global forces that are so difficult and struggle. But yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, in the ways that count, I will raise them in ways that are similar. Mm. But then, you know, I have a husband and he's a different person. He had a different background. So it'll be different in that respect as well. But I don't feel like my parents made mistakes in this way.
You referenced earlier about Kenya, the if I can call her, I guess the protagonist,
yeah,
the protagonist in your novel, right. Sort of feeling like her parents let her down.
Yeah. But, you know,
In ways that parents let children down, yeah. It seems.
Well, I think, you know, everyone's parents let them down. And then, you know, any child who goes to therapy, like, you let me know. But I think that for Kenya, their breakup is the family's breakup is so dramatic, and Sheila's sort of moves towards self-invention are so dramatic. And I think, you know, she feels like they let her down in this way. But I think that, you know, most coming of age novels are about breaking with your parents and being able to critique your parents. And so that there always has to be that tension and that element in the.
Yeah. And her parents do separate, and her mom moves to the suburbs. She goes to this private school, and her mom has this boyfriend, a guy named Teddy,
right,
who's a frightening guy.
Yeah, Teddy Jeffrey.
Yes.
He's the only villain in the novel.
And a complete villain. I mean, he's basically, menaces her and threatens. I mean, it seems like he wants to sexually abuse her,
right,
essentially.
Yeah. She feels let down by that. I mean, so in the novel, Sheila doesn't really know about that for some time, but I think Kenya also just feels let down that she would even get involved with a man who's so shallow and awful. And, you know, I think that I was interested in what that would mean for their relationship, like the tension.
The mother-daughter.
Particularly because Teddy doesn't technically cross that line. Right. So what situation does that put them in?
Right. You know? He sits on her bed and, you know, it becomes uncomfortable.
Right.
And she's obviously frightened of him.
Right.
And he, you know, in the beginning, he talks a good game too.
Yeah. But he's always like kind of shallow and awful. So, but attractive.
But very attractive. Right. Yeah. But I was thinking about the two sort of main male characters, her father and Teddy. I mean, they are a bit of a disappointment, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but I mean, I think most of the characters in the book are a disappointment in a way. I mean, I just think, Sheila is probably the second most sympathetic character, but a lot of the other women are not that, you know. I mean, I think the character besides Kenya who's the most sympathetic is like her little sister Amandala. You know, I think. And so, you know, in a certain way, the adults are not that useful. And it's about her trying to figure out how she's going to stand up for herself.
Right.
Right.
Right. In the world and also sort of within her own community and her own family.
Yeah, in her own home,
And community, and it's important to everybody and certainly to every child, but it's certainly very important to her.
Right. Yeah, it is. I mean, that's how she's been raised. She's been raised as a... And, you know, it says early on that Sheila and John Brown basically have no family. They had to sort of make a community for themselves. And so that's how they raise her to think about living in the world.
And at one point they tell her, oh, and by the way, we're not married.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Surprise,
right? Yeah, no. So my parents were married and they're still... I should mention they're still married.
There
is no... But I think once my mom, for a joke, said, you know, me and your father never married.
It's a joke?
Yeah, it was a joke. I mean, it was – see, the thing about my parents and my mom in particular is, like, she was always sort of trying to push us to see certain kinds of ways of thinking about people as – like, for example, the word illegitimate. She hated that word, you know, like, and not because she, you know, her parents are married, but she just thought it was an awful way to refer to people, you know, you were not, or like that there was something wrong with not being married, you know, so she's always trying to push us to sort of like this, it's kind of feminist, sort of progressive way of thinking about things beyond just race and racism. And so she sort of, it's a weird joke, like, oh, we're not married. Are you upset about that? Why would you be upset about that? You know, doesn't matter.
And I guess you believed her for a second.
I did. And I was sort of like, oh, I guess I'm, you know, conservative.
I'm conservative.
A little more than I thought, because I'm alarmed by this, you know. But yeah, it turned out they were, and she was had a very strange sense of humor.
Okay, that's funny. This book, you know, you've written fiction before, but this, I guess, is your first novel,
right?
I mean, did you have? I always ask writers if they have, you know, ways of writing.
Like a routine, or
things that they do to kind of get their head in the right place.
I think like when you have small kids and a full-time job, you don't have the luxury of most of those things. I mean, like now with the teaching job, I usually, and the kids are in daycare, preschool, I write in the summer. Mm-hmm. The only thing I kind of do is, I learned this in grad school, I used to do it with other women, is like set a timer for 45 minutes and take a break after 45 minutes. And when I worked with other women, we would like go to parts of this house, write on our dissertations, and then gossip and take snacks for 15 minutes and then go back to writing. So I tend to write in like those chunks. I'm not one of those people who could sit down at a computer for 5 hours and then I just, no. So, yeah, but I think maybe like when my kids are gone, I'll be able to get into special like rituals and tea and things to write. But it's like, oh, do I have time? Okay. You know.
Well, it's because you teach creative writing. I mean, it's one thing, I guess, to teach creative writing, and it's another to do it.
Yeah. No, it's very different. I mean, those two things. Mm-hmm. You're talking a lot about things that you hope you're doing in your own work, but it does feel like a different part of your brain.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were a little girl, I mean, did you think, I want to be a writer? Is that what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I mean, I guess I did. I must have thought that. But I wasn't a person who went around saying that. I mean, literature and writing and stories was such a part of my background that it makes a lot of sense. So, and it also makes a lot of sense that I didn't necessarily articulate it that mm-hmm. way.
Yeah. But that, I mean, do you feel like you've written two books? Do you feel like you are?
Do I feel like I'm a writer? Yeah. Yeah, sure, I guess. I'll probably. Although it's funny, I remember going to a reading of the writer Gloria Naylor, and she said something like, until I'd written four books, I didn't think of myself as a writer. And I thought, oh, pshaw. But now I kind of see what it, you know, you feel it's presumptuous to say you're a writer. But yeah, I'm a writer.
So does that mean you're thinking about?
No, it means I'm a writer. I mean, it's also something that's not so precious that I can't say. You know, I'm not saying I'm king of the world or anything. I'm just a writer.
And are you thinking about another book? Or
I am, but I really have not had a lot of time to deal with that. Right. But yeah, no, I'm thinking about it. And yeah, hopefully this summer I'll find some time.
We're almost out of time here. What does Asali mean, your first name?
It means honey.
Oh.
Yeah. It means honey. And my middle name, Najuma, means abounding with joy.
Oh, wow.
But that's how you can tell I was a first child. Because
what's your sister's name?
My sister's name is Akiba Jiribu. Oh, my God. I'm blanking on. Well, one of those means one who tries. Oh, treasure reserved for tomorrow. So it's that's like your second child. You've had the experience of having a newborn that you unwittingly named Honey Abounding with Joy. So, yeah. Good thing they didn't have a third child.
I was just thinking, and who was the third child?
Yeah, right.
That's great. Asali Solomon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The novel is called Disgruntled. And again, she teaches creative writing and English literature at Haverford College. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Send us an email, and you can also follow us on Facebook, and you can also download a podcast of the program as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.